Welcome to the Daily Bolster. Each day, we welcome transformational executives to share their real-world experiences and practical advice about scaling yourself, your team, and your business.
Welcome to the Daily Bolster. I'm Matt Blumberg, co-founder and CEO of Bolster, and I'm here today with my friend Kevin Ryan. Kevin is founder and CEO of Ally Corp, and by extension, founder or co-founder of a large number of some of the kind of most storied and iconic internet brands in the history of the internet in New York City, companies like MongoDB and Guild Group and Insider. Kevin, of course, was the CEO of DoubleClick, the company that really kind of, I don't know, sort of gave birth to the New York tech scene in a lot of ways, or at least the ad tech internet scene. So Kevin, great to have you here.
Very happy to be here.
So I've been looking forward to this one because I love doing these Friday interviews where I get to sort of walk through someone's career with them. Yours has just been so fascinating been a pleasure to kind of have a view into it since you and I first met. I think, what did we just decide, in 1996?
Yeah, a long time ago. Yeah, 96, probably 97. Probably 97. 97, I was guessing.
It was right after you started as CFO at DoubleClick.
Yeah.
So I'd love to start actually very quickly pre-DoubleClick. Mm-hmm. I remember you were United Media for a little while, mm-hmm. right? Sort of dawn of the internet. And were you a management consultant before that?
No. Before that, after business school, I worked for 2 or 3 years at Disney at the opening of Euro Disney in Paris. Because I went to INSEAD for business school, stayed in Paris for 3 years, then came back to New York to work at United Media for 2 or 3 years. And previous to business school, I was an investment banker in New York and London for 4 years.
So what did you work on at Euro Disney? Like the actual opening and launch?
Or? Yeah. No, I was there a year before the launch, and I was actually working on the Disney MGM Studios, which was a park that had not yet opened. So that was going to open, and it did open several years later. And so I was in finance. I was making my transition from investment banking into operations. And so I was in finance for about a year working on that, and then moved over into hotel operations and finance. So really helping, we had 15,000 hotel rooms. So it's like a city, and helping to figure out how we needed to run those better.
So equally interesting to online media, but quite different. How did you transition from one to the other when you moved back to the US?
Yeah, so the only job actually in my entire life that I didn't really like that much was working at Disney. It was very big. It was very bureaucratic. And so it wasn't slow moving. It wasn't that fun. And so I wanted something smaller. And randomly, through a friend of mine, found out about a CFO, COO job of 180-person division of EW Scripps, which was a media company. And Scripps owned newspapers and TV stations and things like that. And there's a special division that wasn't doing well. So they needed a CFO, COO. And most people didn't want to do it because the company was not doing that well, but I didn't care. And so for me, that was a huge job. I was managing about 60 people. And we ended up turning it around. Originally, the plan was to sell it, but then the parent company said, keep it and grow it because we're doing so well. And part of the growth strategy was I started an internet site in 95, which was very, very early. The Dilbert site. It became very, very successful relative to sites at that time. We had advertising, we had e-commerce, we had to do it all ourselves because there were no tools. And so at the beginning of 96, that led to my entire 25-year career after that, because I became convinced, which now doesn't look like a genius move, that the internet was going to be a big, big industry. Someday everyone would be on the internet and have an email address and buy things and date and do whatever. And so I wanted to leave and to go start or join an internet company.
Yeah, but you're right. It was not an obvious decision. I mean, I remember my first project at MoviePhone, which was right around the same time. Mm-hmm. It was in 95, was to answer the question of whether or not we should build a website. In the rearview mirror, some things seem more obvious than they were at the time.
And actually, part of the reason I left was I went to the parent company as a loyal corporate citizen and said, look, this internet thing is going to be big. We have a head start. You should give me $2 million and I'll build up an internet division. And I think it's a really good idea. And they said no. And one of the things they asked me, which has not stood the test of time, is they said, we don't know if we want to invest in this internet. We may wait for the next one. And I was like, you have no idea what you're talking about. There's no next internet coming. So I think I need to leave you. You're part of my problem, not part of my solution.
Right.
And so I started talking to companies in Silicon Valley and in New York.
And actually, it's funny. I didn't realize you were talking on both coasts. What kept you in New York instead of moving out to the, you know, the Golden State?
Yeah. Well, I really always preferred large cities. I'd been living, you know, I lived in Paris, London, and New York in the previous 10 years. And so that's where I want to be. I thought there was a chance I just wasn't going to be able to stay in New York, because at the time there was, you know, very close to zero happening here. There's probably 50 people working in the internet at that time. But I ran across, you know, DoubleClick, and which was probably 10, 15 people, and two brilliant guys who had started it. And I ended up joining them and was able to stay in New York. But I had offers to join Excite, which was early stage, you know, search engine and some other things out on the West Coast as well.
Yeah, no, that's right. There was very little tech in New York, not just, you know, not just internet. There wasn't a ton of software in New York.
No, we couldn't even find a lawyer in New York to take us public, because no companies had gone public in New York. So the whole public team was out in the Bay Area for almost every single law firm at the time.
Yeah. So you joined DoubleClick in what year, in 99 or 98?
June 96.
96. Okay. So you were CFO at first, you got promoted to president, got promoted to CEO.
Yeah.
You were CEO when the company went public.
No, I was still president, when the company went public.
So talk a little bit about like the heyday, right? The ride up and the IPO. Cause you know, today it's so far in the rearview mirror now, but for those of us, who lived through it, it's probably still quite vivid. That time is very vivid for me, but you and I both manage, you know, some employees who are under 30 or under 25.
Yeah.
Like it's like ancient history for them.
No, and it was incredible because, you know, in 94, 95, we didn't even know the word internet. It didn't even exist.
Right.
And so then to think that, you know, a couple of years later in 98, 24 months after DoubleClick started, you know, we took the company public. It was worth $350 million, which at the time seemed enormous. Don't forget, Apple went public and raised $9 million at their IPO. So at the time, this seemed like a very big IPO. And then, you know, 2 years after we went public at a $300 million valuation, we were worth $12 billion. So the bubble had hit. We were growing like crazy. We did $500 million in revenue after 4 years. And, you know, everything was going well. I mean, it just, you couldn't imagine it be going better. It felt like you were just in a dream world. All your employees were happy. Your investors thought you were the smartest thing you'd ever seen. Everything was working. We moved into our new office, and I remember we closed $12 million worth of business that day but via our telemarketers. We were selling ads. You know, so it was like just there were gold coins everywhere until there weren't.
Until there weren't. And I remember distinctly one of the things you told me sort of post IPO was that that one of the smartest things that that you did was sort of time the capital markets right around not your IPO raise but the secondary raise.
Yeah. So I in the beginning of 2000 I was actually skiing in Europe, and the value of DoubleClick went up by $1 billion during the week on no news. Just, and I remember thinking, you know, this feels very rich. I mean, because there's no news. $1 billion is real money. And, you know, my father worked for Caterpillar for 20 years, and we were almost as valuable as Caterpillar, which just didn't seem to make sense. So I thought, you know, we should go out and raise, do a big secondary and have cash, because worst case is if we end up being worth $30 billion, no one's gonna fire me for having raised money because we're worth $30 billion. But if things go down, which I think is possible, this will be really helpful. So we went out and it was very difficult. We're trying to raise $1 billion, had problems, only raised $800 million. But that $800 million, in a way, saved the company, not just because we had the cash, but when you were choosing between us and another company that had $10 million in the bank and you're making a five-year commitment, where are you going to go? Especially given that four of our competitors just went bankrupt last week. And the guy who's making the decision, who's like you, got fired. Because you're like, why did you choose a bankrupt vendor? And we were the safe choice, and you know, had the most engineers and the most market share, and we were actually a good choice.
Yeah, yeah, and you know, obviously that more than a rainy day fund.
Yeah, and we needed a lot of it because during 2.5 years, 70% of our clients went bankrupt. That's not helpful. In case you're wondering.
No, and that's the thing I always tell people that was different about the, you know, the dot-com bust or whatever you call it and a recession today. It's that all of your customers, all of my customers, they were just gone overnight.
And not only were they gone, but they obviously didn't pay you the last 3 months that they owed you, that they told you was coming, but it was never coming. So you ate a lot of that, in addition to losing the revenues going forward.
Yeah.
So we did 7 rounds of layoffs. We had 2,000 employees. And then we didn't know. I mean, we didn't know how long it was going to last. And your theory should do 1 round of layoff, but just had no idea. So it just kept going and going and going. So then we're, contrary to my earlier point, all your shareholders think you're an idiot. Your employees suspect you're probably an idiot. Every decision you made in the previous year looks terrible. You know, I signed a lease to be able to fit 2,000 people, a 12-year lease. And then I had to get out of it. Real estate prices collapsed. I had to write a check for $80 million to get out of that lease. Cash. That would have bankrupted any normal company. But it was actually better because it saved me $10 million a year in rent for 10 years in a row. And you took the value back and it was just made more sense. But brutal. I mean,
yeah.
You know, people I had personally recruited and convinced to leave their job making $300,000 to come make $150,000 for me. And then 5 months later, we fire them. And there were no jobs. There's no chance that person's going to get a job anytime soon. You don't feel good about that.
No, you don't. But so what are some lessons you took from that? There are obviously a lot of lessons you take from on the way up. But what are some lessons that you took from that, you know, sort of awful period from late 2000 into 2002?
Well, one thing on the positive side, the reason DoubleClick today is still, and this is literally 25 years later, the dominant player in, you know, ad technology in the world is because we move faster than everyone else between 96 and 2000. And DoubleClick has never given that position up. It's like being on the risk board. You take all the countries and then you can protect them. And so, you know, we had to pay a price for that, but long-term, you know, I don't know what DoubleClick is worth today, but it's probably, you know, 50 billion, 100 billion or some large number because of that. So no pain, no gain. You know, you obviously in retrospect wish you had not been as aggressive, not made some acquisitions, not taken as much real estate, but you also never know. There were companies in 96 who were like, oh no, this is a bubble. We're going to stay out of it and not expand. And we ate their lunch for 2 years, ended up 10 times larger, 10 times better brand, and then, you know, caught a lot of people and survived, and sometimes they went out of business.
Yeah. And so I should say this, it's a little silly saying it to you, but for some of the people listening. So when you say DoubleClick is big today and it's a standard today, yeah, and it's worth $50 billion, DoubleClick is part of Google.
Yes. They bought it for about $3 billion in 2007, 2008. Yeah. So this is a theoretical valuation, but it's a very important acquisition for Google and an important part of their company.
Yeah, for sure. So let's talk about the origins of Alicorp. So mm-hmm. You wrap up your time at DoubleClick. I can't remember if you did something in between the two or if you sort of helped start a business or two and then it became Alicorp.
Yeah, I mean, we could debate when officially Alicorp started, but basically right in the beginning, Dwight, who was the CTO and co-founder of DoubleClick, and I had ideas for companies. And so we started companies and we started a number of them. We started Mongo, we started Business Insider, we started Gilt, and we started one called ShopWiki, which we sold, didn't do that well. We started one called Panther Express, didn't do that great, lost money on it. But overall, you know, created 3 very, very, very successful companies during that period of time. And we spent a lot of our time in the next 5 years building them up. Dwight is still on the board of Mongo, and I was on the board for 12 or 13 years.
And how do you, you know, it's funny when you know, conventional wisdom is you can't do that, right? Conventional wisdom is, you know, start a company, focus on one thing, you know, you're not a portfolio as a CEO. How did you, or even the two of you, kind of work through so many different things, right? Insider Group and Insider Gilt and Mongo couldn't be more different, all three of them.
And all different from DoubleClick. There was actually a Harvard Business School case that was written, and it's unusual to do that, about me. And the thesis was, what has happened here are all the things we teach at Harvard Business School that you can't do, but they seem to be working. So what does that tell us? There was no answer there. I think we just did the things we wanted to do and, you know, managed to have a number of successes and then have had successes, you know, since then. I've had a lot of successes in healthcare, new areas. And so I think if you can, focus on, do you have a good idea and do you have a great team, that there's some pattern recognition. I think what I do is what original VC was. Today VC is often very late stage. It's almost private equity. You write them a $25 million check. They already have a business and you try and add a little bit of value. We are really putting teams together, helping them, working with them, helping them recruit, helping them get customers, doing that work, that hard work. And I think on average, we've shown that you can do this. Alicorp over 10, 12 years has had well over a 50% IRR on hundreds of millions of dollars invested. And so that's comparable or better than the top VC firms in the entire country.
So let's dig into the three first big successes. And yeah. I'm just curious, what made them succeed? What made Insider succeed? Let's start with that one.
Yeah. So, and the most interesting thing of the three was that if I saw you 2 years after they all started, because they started the same year, I would have told you that Gilt just did $175 million in its second year, which is insane. No, I don't think any business in New York City has ever done that, still to this day. Business Insider was doing about $1 million. So, okay, but obviously not the same. And then Mongo did zero. And then the next year did zero. And you and I would not have guessed that the zero was going to be worth $30 billion someday. And that the Gilt company was going to be the least valuable out of the three. We sold it for $250 million. We sold Business Insider for about $450 million. But the simple premise for Business Insider was that there was no business site that I wanted to read at the time. And that no business site was adapted to the fact that you could check your email every day, every minute. And so the Wall Street Journal and Business Week did not update their websites during the day, which people now can't even imagine that was true. But they were still on the schedule of, we publish in the morning.
Right.
Everyone, publishes their story late at night and it comes out in the morning. And that's just how we roll. And we published during the day. And the second thing we did was have punchy headlines like, this, they just made a bad acquisition. So you'd never have that sort of editorial point of view in a Wall Street Journal article or a Business Week. The article would say they paid X. Some people think it was too much. Some people think it was the right amount. Time will tell.
Right.
And ours was more interesting. And most of the internet, not because of us, but we were one of the early players that did that. And it's punchier and more opinionated, more fun, shorter. And, there was room for that.
Yeah. So that's a business that I would say was sort of driven by internet norms, right?
Yes.
And would you say the same about Gilt in a different way?
Yeah, Gilt was a different thing. I saw this business model in France that no one knew about, which is essentially the Gilt business model. It's a company called Vente Privée. And they were just selling fashion at a discount every day. And it was counter to the internet norm. Internet norm is that everything's available all the time, unlimited selection. And we had limited selection, only available for a little bit of time, but at a big discount. And that, scratched an itch. And I started that business partly because I walked by an 18th Street, a sample sale, which I never went to, but mostly women. But there were 200 women waiting in line to get, Marc Jacobs at 50% off. And I remember thinking, I bet there's thousands of women in Philadelphia and all these other places that don't have access to this. Not to mention there are people sitting in their office at Goldman Sachs who secretly would like to be in this line, but they actually have a job. And if I could bring that to them, and we had moments where we had 100,000 people, in line waiting to shop. It shows you that there was room for this.
Yeah. All right. And now let's go to Mongo. So again, completely different business. I guess you could also say sort of, created by the internet, or the need was spotted, but super deep technical business.
Yeah. Well, one, I could not, I'm not, deeply technical, but I had two co-founders who were incredibly brilliant, Dwight and then Elliot Horowitz, who was the young, most brilliant engineer we had at DoubleClick out of 500 engineers. It was like up and coming LeBron James at age 19. And so could not have done it without them. Here's what we knew at the time. Two big points. One is that data was changing. Data was all rows and columns structured data in 2007. And over time, we were going to have video and facial recognition and things like that. And all that stuff needed to be stored. It was basically unstructured data. And so the databases that at the time were not the right databases technically for that. Secondly, that it needed to be open source. And that three, that the existing players like Oracle, were very big and very expensive. They had 40% profit margins. And, congrats to them. but that means there's an opening for a less expensive, you know, easier to use open source database. And that's what we created. And today it does $2 billion in revenue and, you know, will be a $50 billion company, I think, at some point.
Yeah, that's just, I mean, all three of them are remarkable. And what's most remarkable is how different they are and that you started them all at the same time.
One of the things that's validating about Business Insider is, you know, there are moments where BuzzFeed was more valuable things. I think Business Insider may today be the most valuable online media company started during that whole era, more so than the Huffington Post, which is, you know, more or less disappeared, more than Vice, which went bankrupt, more than BuzzFeed. Because it was sustainable and has a niche that today has, you know, 1,000 employees and $300 million in revenue. And then we sold it 9 years ago, but it's extraordinary success.
Yeah. And it really has been lasting and, it's probably overwhelmed its parent company at this point.
Yeah.
So when you, so you built on the success of those three, Alicorp today is a large organization, right? It's not you and Dwight creating a few businesses.
No.
What's the scope of it today?
Yeah. So we have 24 people here, mostly on the investment side. So bigger than most teams in New York. We start 8 companies a year, roughly. We invest in probably 20 new companies. We have an overall portfolio of about 130 companies. We invest $75 to $100 million per year into those two buckets. And, you know, whether we start it or invest in it, we're doing mostly early stage and we're building these companies up. So I started Zola, which does hundreds of millions of dollars of revenue. Nomad Health, also doing hundreds of millions of dollars of revenue. An investor in Walla, which is a mobile bank in Argentina, which is worth $2 billion. Blue Ground, which is worth probably close to $1 billion. So just, you know, helping these companies grow over time. It takes 5 to 10 years. Now we have big specialized practices. So I have 40% of what I do is in healthcare, 40% is in diversified tech, 10% in robotics, and 10% in social impact. So very specialized people. I also have resources that no one else has. I have a 65-person engineering team, my own in-house outsourced engineering company. Engineers are either in Colombia or in Montreal. So I can build up a tech infrastructure and team very quickly. I have a 10-person executive search firm called Soul Search that we co-own with Michelle Garland, who's the senior partner there to look for healthcare executives. I have Digital Health New York, which I started, which is the largest digital health conference in New York. All those things are strategic assets that help us build, promote our companies. And so that's what we're doing.
What do you look for in a founder? Right, you're starting 8 companies a year. You got to find 8 founders a year.
Yeah. You know, look, you're looking for passion. You're looking for competence. Sometimes they really know the sector very well. Sometimes they're coming in from outside and have that perspective. It's okay. They need to be a good manager. That's essential in our industry because we have, you know, 1% unemployment in tech. And so no one's going to go work for someone who's an asshole. So I need to know that they can recruit and they can keep and maintain and motivate a team. You know, they don't need to be the specialist in any one thing generally because they're the CEO, but they need to be able to handle ahead of sales, ahead of finance, ahead of marketing, you know, ahead of HR, all those things and make them feel good about it. So, but you don't always get it right either. It's an imprecise science. But yeah, in general, I feel pretty happy with a lot. I mean, Henry Blodgett, 15 years later, he was one of 7 people I interviewed for that job. 15 years later, was still the CEO of Business Insider and scaled from having, I think he had never managed 2 people before or very few to 1,000 people. Great to see him.
Yeah. I mean, it is one of the things, I don't know if you keep count of this, but I mean, I just off the top of my head can think of 12 people who worked at DoubleClick over the years who went on to be CEO of something else.
Yeah.
Right. And it's probably dozens.
So. Oh yeah. We found, once we added up and we found 32 people who had become CEO, sometimes small, but sometimes very large. Mm-hmm. David Rosenblatt's running First Dibs, publicly traded company, but you know, many, many, many examples of that. And so great to see.
And do you feel like they take, I mean, you're still in touch with a bunch of them. Is there like a leadership blueprint or playbook or something that you feel like, you know, DoubleClick trained to or?
Not specifically. I think it's more that they were in an environment where they saw success. And look, we had a choice of our people, as you said earlier. you know, for several years, DoubleClick was the hottest company and the most valuable in New York. So we got our choice and did, I think, a good job of recruiting many, many talented people to come join that. And then they watch it. They worked with other talented people. They saw good things and bad things. And they thought, you know what? I can do that too. And they had relationships. They had a resume. So they walked in and said, yeah, I worked at DoubleClick for several years. We helped each other a lot. I mean, I've done 30 reference calls for DoubleClick people over the years. Yes, you should hire him. Yes, you should invest in him. Still do today. And, you know, I'm, you know, the entire Gilt senior management team, Zola team all worked at Gilt. Security Scorecard, $1 billion security company in New York, was my head of security at Gilt. I'm an investor in that. We're all helping each other and encouraging them. And that's what's so amazing about New York is you're just watching that ecosystem grow and grow and grow first through first, second, third generation.
Yeah, it is amazing. And I know one of the things you do, you're on the vice chair of Tech NYC. When you think about the New York tech scene, not just looking backwards and you know, kind of how much it's grown over the last 25 years, but you think about the next 25 years, what does it look like? How does it start to grow from here? You know, it's already sort of, okay, it's the number two, and then there are a bunch of number threes, but you know, how do you think about
it? Unquestionably comes the number one tech city. That will happen. We are just watching industries create. So I always remind people that only 5 years ago today, you might have said to me, Kevin, there's not a single publicly traded startup, tech startup in New York that's worth more than $3 billion. And that was true. And you can't name a single enterprise software company started in New York that is public. And that was true just 5 years ago. Today, the two most valuable companies created in the last 30 years here are Datadog and MongoDB, the only two that are roughly $30 billion or above, so getting some real scale and will continue to grow. They will, over time, spin out, you know, 100 people. And you know what they're going to do? They're going to start enterprise software companies. And you know where they're going to start them? In New York City. You and I lived through a period in the 90s where companies moved from New York to San Francisco if they wanted to be successful. No chance that's happening today. So many, you know, all the VC firms in California are opening offices in New York because they know the talent's here. Look, when every country I'm in, I say, I know where your tech center is going to be. Just tell me where the top 20 universities in your country, where those grads want to live. And that's where it's going to be because our industry is driven by the smartest people, often, but not necessarily from the smartest, best universities. In Germany, that's Berlin. They could have gone to Frankfurt, but you know what? They didn't want to live in Frankfurt. And so Berlin's the capital. And 20 years ago, no one would have imagined that.
Right.
And you know, the classes from top places, they go to New York. We also have benefited from the fact that, which wasn't the case in 1990, that New York is more livable than it was then. Crime rate, murder rate is down 85% since 1990. Whereas San Francisco and other places are worse off from a quality of life. That we got lucky on. But yeah, New York's going to continue to do well.
Yeah, one of the things that's great about New York, and obviously I've made my whole career here as well, is that there's a real center of gravity. And you know, even though there's a lot more stuff in Brooklyn now than there was 10 years ago or 15 years ago, the distance from you know, Flatiron to Brooklyn is not like the distance from Cupertino to San Francisco.
No, it's like 4 miles. I mean, it's literally nothing. It's four subway stops.
Yeah. What role do you think Cornell Tech has played in this?
You know, so I was part of the selection committee to choose the Cornell over the other ones at the time. So I was slightly involved with that, but it's played a small role. But I'm incredibly happy with what they've done. You know, they're now close to 1,000 graduates per year coming out of Cornell that are master's students in a variety of technical subjects. That's fantastic. But, you know, we also have 350,000 people in the city who are working in technology. So it's not single-handedly moving it, but it's contributing to it. I mean, I said this at the time, we could actually use 5 more Cornells and still have room, you know, here. Yeah. It's a big, big ecosystem. We luckily, but I'm so happy. And I think they've done an amazing job in being more innovative than Columbia or NYU and more aggressive because they were the challenger coming in here.
Yeah, no, that's right. And they definitely start companies there. Graduates are starting a lot of companies.
They're just bolder and more commercial in some ways. They're not afraid that someone's starting a company. They don't wake up and think everyone there is going to get a PhD and teach. because they're just not, and right. it's not true elsewhere.
Right.
So yeah, we're, you know, Cornell and Dartmouth and even Yale to a certain extent suffer because they're not in a big city. And it's great undergraduate, but you know, when people are 28 and getting their master's, they're thinking, kind of like to be in a big city where I can date and play on a tennis league and, you know, go to museums and go to clubs and go to the best restaurants.
Yeah. All right. So last question for you. What are you most excited about right now when you look at your portfolio and you just went through the sectors you're investing in, which are pretty yeah. far flung, right? Robotics and healthcare. What gets you most excited right now?
So two things, very different. One is, you know, I've been very deep in psychedelics for mental health. So we've started a company called Transcend in psychedelics. I'm the leading funder of the Yale Center for Psychedelic Research. That's nonprofit research. But we've already raised $40 million for this company after 2 years, and we're taking a compound methylone through the FDA process, and the results are extraordinary so far. And I have three other investments in psychedelic companies, and I'm very, very happy with the results and what's happening across the country at the national level and the state level there. And then secondly, you know, pockets of AI, we're looking at something we haven't announced yet of starting a industry-focused LLM. And, you know, these are huge, big swings that are super interesting to do there. So those are two things I'm pretty excited about. But yeah, and what we do, what you and I have been doing for many years, just remains incredibly fun. The challenge of building a team, competing with other things, doing something new, if it were easy, it would have already been done. And once in a while, it works really well, and everyone's happy.
All right, we'll leave it on that note. Kevin Ryan from Alicorp, thank you so much for spending time with me.
No, thanks for having me.